Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your host today, speaking with Jason Tetrell, a microbiologist known as the Germ Guy, about the role germs can play in food addiction. Jason Tetrell is a Canadian microbiologist, author of two acclaimed popular science books on microbes, The Germ Code in 2014, which was actually shortlisted for Science Book of the Year in Canada, and The Germ Files in 2. Jason has a Bachelor of Science degree in biochemistry, microbiology from the University of Guelph. He makes regular appearances on CBC Radio 1 and other media outlets in Canada and worldwide. So welcome, Jason.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be joining you.
Yes, thank you. I'm so pleased that you were able to come today. We always like to start with a little bit of the personal side. So what got you involved in the world of microbiology?
So this is actually a story that I talk about when I was doing my book tours. And when I was young, about 4 years old, I ended up actually getting an infection. And back then, we didn't understand as much as we do about microbiology. And so I ended up having a massive fever. My parents were very much concerned. The hospital was just saying there's really not much we can do. And there was really a risk for my overall health. And as I grew up after that and recovered, I was always wondering, what was it that infected me? What was it that caused me to have such a great illness? And then I started learning that there were so many people who were suffering from illnesses that were caused by these microbes that it really got me interested in the idea of microbiology. And so I went into that realm at a very young age. My first microbiology job was, I believe, when I was 16 years old. There was a lab at the University of Ottawa. It was really nice. But I got to see what was going on with the way that microbes were affecting us in a negative light. And then later on in life, about 25, 26, I started to actually see the good that microbes could do in our lives. And then all of a sudden, it was all about creating this balance, the good microbes, the not so good microbes, and of course, the ones that are just, they don't care about us at all. And as that developed, I was able to come up with this concept of a relationship with microbes. And that's essentially what led to my first and second books. So that's been my journey. And for those of you who are wondering, it was probably adenovirus that infected me, because if any parent has ever had a child that had a really high fever and they feel like they need to rush into the hospital, odds are it's probably adenovirus.
Thank you so much. All right, so let's get to some of the general information. Both of your books show how microbes touch virtually every part of our lives. What would you say is the most surprising example of how germs influence physical health?
Yeah. So for me, what I found perhaps most surprising was the concept of transmission. And I know that a lot of people out there are going to be like, wait, Jason, we know that microbes can transmit that common cold and everything. I'm not talking about from that end. I'm talking about from the other end. Fecal microbiota that you can transfer to another individual and actually change that individual's physical status simply from the microbes that are coming from the gut. And that in itself is fascinating, because the idea of microbes having that amount of control over your physical health is not only fascinating, but it can also be rather terrifying, because sometimes things can be happening to you when it comes to non-communicable diseases, and you have no idea what's going on. And perhaps one of the most interesting that I find is the idea of how bacteria can actually change the way that your body metabolizes the food that you eat, and how that can be changed from one individual to another. To me, it's an incredible area of research that we're still just understanding, but I think it's going to open up a huge door for medicine, not only in terms of diagnostics, but also for treatments.
Does that relate to the idea where obesity can be seen as transmissible through the bacteria and using fecal transplant? Is that where you were going with that?
Yeah. So obesity is one of the concepts. There's the potential for other kinds. Some of the more outrageous ones that were talked about when I first wrote my books were autism, prevention of Alzheimer's, that type of thing. Now, they haven't really panned out. But when you're talking about things like diabetes or obesity, where the gut microbiome does seem to play a significant role, there is the potential of being able to use treatments in that sense. What I also find fascinating is that, and I want people to understand this, the microbes themselves are part of it, right? We can transfer microbes from one individual to another just through the sharing of biological fluids, eating from the same taco dish or nacho dish or something like that, right? There's the potential for transmission. But what we're talking about as well is the social impact that comes with it and the whole idea of peer pressure that can put stress on you. And maybe if you have a gut microbiome that really isn't helping you to deal with anxiety and stress, you may actually find yourself more vulnerable to peer pressure. Like, these are the types of things that I was reading when I was writing the book. Honestly, it's fascinating how the microbes can play a role in it. Now, granted, we haven't gotten to a point where we've proven every little bit of hypothesis, but by the same respect, we now know that there is a social component to obesity, which is absolutely fascinating because no one would have thought about that before.
I was really intrigued when I read in your book where you talked about kissing, just kissing.
Yeah.
Way to determine, if this is a good kiss, my microbiome is telling me this person is meant for me as opposed to I should avoid this person.
Yeah, it's fascinating because that whole idea came from an original study where they were using t-shirts. And so the t-shirts would get really sweaty and then they put them in a bottle and then people would inhale them. And then what they did is they looked at the microbiome of those individuals. And what they found was that there was this similarity in some cases. In other cases, it was really more about the immune system. And you have to also understand something. When we talk about microbes in relation to our health, you can't talk about that unless you talk about the immune system as well. And as much as we're going to have a discussion about microbes, I may venture into immunology, which is another one of my expertise, to be able to provide some of that perspective as to why this is happening. And it definitely looks like the immune system plays a role in how we react to other people, including when we kiss.
Yeah. So that's physical health. That's just one example. So what about mental health? What can you say about microbes touching our mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that was started probably about 2009, 2010 was the idea of psychobiotics, because what we found was that there is a sort of a third brain, if you will, inside your gut. And it is responsible for the creation of the same types of hormones that you have in your brain that control your mental health. Serotonin is probably the prime example. And when you start thinking about serotonin levels, you not only start thinking about the brain, but you also start thinking about the gut. And what we have found is that there are bacterial species out there that are known to either support or actually produce serotonin in the gut. With that in mind, it's one of those ideas where, could we start using bacteria to be able to influence the mental health of another individual? And one of the things that we found out is that the colon itself has a link to the brain through something called the vagal nerve or vagal efferents. And then that will allow you to be able to have something in your gut that will have an effect on your brain. And every single person here already knows how that feels. Because have you ever had a meal where the next morning you wake up and you go,
I don't feel so good.
And you just feel horrible and everything. And then you have your constitutional, you get rid of all of that and suddenly you feel better. What you're doing is you're evacuating out all of those metabolites that have had an effect, and it's having an effect on your brain as well. And believe it or not, there's also something else that can show you that, yes, indeed, there is a link between the colon and your brain. It's jokingly called poo-phoria. But sometimes when you go to the bathroom and you have that release or the movement outside of your bowels into the toilet, your brain will actually feel an endorphin high.
Oh my God.
Yes. And it's rather amusing because the phenomenon actually does exist, and it has nothing to do with the microbes themselves. It actually has to do with your muscles and how they react, and there are nerves that are happening in that area that send up signals of euphoria or delight up to your brain. Yeah, there is definitely a link between your colon and your brain in that sense.
Oh, that's so interesting. Now, when you were talking about that morning after feeling. I think, when have I had that morning after feeling? It's after I've eaten a whole lot of processed food the night before. And so I would imagine that it's the processed food specifically that can disrupt the gut-brain axis. Am I thinking in the right lines here?
Yeah, I mean, you're heading in the right direction. So when we're having different types of foods, it's going to have a different effect on the microbes that are in our gut. And depending on what kind of food it is, and we can get into that a bit later, you're going to have a different effect on the types of microbes that grow, how much they're going to grow, and more importantly, what they are going to produce as metabolites or byproducts. Because it's not the bacteria themselves, for the most part, that are causing problems or benefit. It's what they produce that creates an effect on our bodies. And if you're having a meal that is full of saturated fat, high, easy to digest sugars, and possibly meat that maybe doesn't necessarily, it's not the leanest meat in the world, then there's a very good likelihood that you're going to end up having a number of different byproducts that your body is going to feel antagonistic to. And that's going to make your immune system react badly, and it's in turn going to make you feel unwell. On the other hand, if you're eating foods that are going to be creating byproducts from these bacteria that your body likes, that helps to calm the immune system, then there's a good likelihood mentally you're going to feel a bit happier or a bit more calm. And that's the whole idea behind psychobiotics. How can we get the bacteria that are going to create those lovely molecules that make us feel happy and calm? And then how do we use a diet to be able to help them propagate?
Thank you. We're always really interested in just mentioning the concept of Alzheimer's, because we now in this field recognize Alzheimer's as like type 3 diabetes. It's also a whole insulin, lack of sensitivity, but there's also a microbiome aspect. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, sure. Like you were just saying, Alzheimer's is a very complex disease. There's no singular cause. And this is the case with a lot of neurodegenerative disorders. In terms of the microbial contributions, you have to look at it from two different lights. The first one is essentially a direct infection that is somehow migrated to the brain. This is where we have something like a herpes virus or an Epstein-Barr virus. That is completely separate from the microbiome. Because when we talk about the gut microbiome, okay, we're talking about the byproducts and the metabolites that are having an effect on the body that then somehow causes something to happen in the brain. Now, what we found over years and years of study is that the onset of this disease, along with others, tends to be associated with inflammation inside of the body. And when we look at the microbiome of patients, we find that there are higher numbers of bacteria known to make those byproducts or molecules that cause inflammation. Now, there's lots and lots of Latin here, but I'm just going to give you a few names you may have heard of. E. coli, Shigella, Streptococcus. You've probably heard them all as pathogens. There are different species that are not as pathogenic. They won't make you sick, but they can lead to the development of inflammation. And if there's too much of them, then that inflammation can get out of hand. That's one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is that you start to lose the bacteria that produce those molecules that make you feel calm and happy and relax the immune system. One of them that everyone's probably going to know is Bifidobacterium. That's the probiotic, okay? If you start to see a shift towards those more inflamed bacteria and less of those probiotic bacteria, then you start to have a more inflamed context of the body when it comes to your immune system, all right? And here's the thing that nobody really does understand at this stage, is the inflammation that is occurring in your bloodstream crossing over through the blood-brain barrier into your brain, creating inflammation that is then leading your brain to think, oh my goodness, we're under attack, we need to do something about it. Okay. Or is it because there is some other kind of process that is occurring in the spinal fluid that is then reaching to the brain to create those messages of inflammation and problems? We haven't really figured out that answer, okay? But that hasn't really stopped us from trying to use the microbiome to improve Alzheimer's. Now, again, we're talking mainly animal studies here, but the fecal transplants that I talked about, they do seem to be able to help slow progression in animals, which is great. There's a paper out there that has focused on one individual, just one person, but that person also seems to have slowed progression. And so that theory or hypothesis that the inflammation caused by the microbes in the gut have an effect on the development or risk for the development of Alzheimer's disease does seem to be there. Now we just need to do more studies to confirm how much of a contribution there is.
Just to summarize, you said that Alzheimer's, it's multifactorial. And so one could be viruses like Epstein-Barr or herpes virus, which I actually didn't know that was in the running. And then my understanding has always been inflammation, yes, but because of the insulin being totally messed up. And so there's inflammation there. And so now you're adding a third piece, which is the microbial piece, that there might be some inflammation. You also said that the microbiome has an effect on the immune system. Does that play a role with Alzheimer's?
The immune system itself is a very, it's a complicated system that has its own ability to balance itself out. And what we're finding is that in a number of non-communicable diseases, chronic diseases, including Alzheimer's, including neurodegenerative disorders, there seems to be a miscommunication in that balance. The way that the immune system works is this. You have three major branches. One is fight, fight, fight. That is the one that goes on when you have an infection, and it just essentially goes wild to make sure that the infection is gone. The second one is a protective. It's essentially in place to be sure that nothing is sneaking around causing any problems. And then the third one is what we call pro-inflammatory. And what that means is it keeps your immune system in a state of basically like a cold war. It's just always on alert, waiting for the next thing.
And that's the inflammatory response you're talking about.
That's essentially what is happening, is that we're seeing a shift more towards that pro-inflammatory. So the body is continually readying itself for some kind of fight. And so we have the ability to balance that. Okay. It's called the regulatory system. And when the regulatory isn't working, then pushing towards that pro-inflammatory. And then if it gets too much, then your body will either go to the fight inadvertently, which we call autoimmunity, or it will go into this sort of protective layer where it starts shutting things down to be able to prepare itself for losing a battle. Now, in both of those cases, there are significant problems because essentially it's very bad for you. So what we want to do is we want to try and make sure that we're balancing out that pro-inflammatory. And that's really where the probiotics and the good bacteria and the good metabolites that are coming from those bacteria play a role.
That's fascinating. This is a bit off script, but I have to ask you, type 1 diabetes, we talk about it as being genetic, but I've read that it actually is something that might actually be transmissible in some way. Is there some thought that the microbiome has a role to play in type 1 diabetes, not type 2?
I worked on it way back in the early 1990s, and we were all working on the hypothesis that there's a virus.
Yes, exactly.
This hypothetical virus. And that virus was leading to the destruction of the islet cells, to the autoimmunity through epitope mimicry. We could never prove it. And then I moved on to different things. But what I can tell you is that the idea of diabetes being transmissible, probably from a type 2 perspective, absolutely, because that is really metabolism based. From a type 1 perspective, I would have difficulty being able to show that. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not really my expertise. So it's definitely something whereby you could talk with someone who has done their research in the type 1 diabetes world to find out whether or not there's been any movement in the virus hypothesis or the transmissibility.
Okay, thank you. There's been a general understanding that the standard American diet, the SAD diet, has been destructive to us, to our gut microbiome, to just everything about our health. Could the rise in obesity and the type of eating that we're doing, has that caused a destruction to possibly protective microbes that our ancestors have that we no longer are eating?
Yes, the missing microbes hypothesis. Yes. About 10 years ago, there was that belief. And there was even a gentleman who wrote a book on it. It was called Missing Microbes. And the whole idea was that we've grown up in a society that has rejected certain microbes as a result of our diet, as a result of antibiotic use, et cetera, et cetera. And while that does play a role, and we have seen over the years the effect of antibiotics on the microbiome and the change in diet and lifestyle and how that affects the microbiome, what we're beginning to realize is that it's a little bit more subtle than just the missing microbes hypothesis. Because in the short term, no matter what you're doing, the gut microbiome doesn't change all that much. And when you start incorporating some good things like exercise, food limitation, other interventions, the diversity doesn't really alter particularly, right? It's not that there's potentially missing microbes. It's the fact that there are certain gatekeepers that help to prevent inflammation from happening. And we have a couple of Latin names like Faecalibacterium praesnitzii, Acromantia mucinophilia. These are types of bacteria that are known to help us remove a lot of the issues that come with those byproducts and pathogens. And they also produce a lot of really good byproducts that can help our gut essentially stay more stable and then lead to those immune responses that are good for us. When those bacteria disappear, we do tend to see a higher level of inflammation in the body, or at least you have a greater risk for it. And then that leads to the downstream effects of weight gain, obesity, and yes, even food addiction. And we can talk about that as well. If you find that lifestyle behaviors can help to tone down that inflammation, but you still don't have those gatekeepers, then you may end up finding yourself not having as much success. The problem, unfortunately, is that in both of these cases, these bacteria are not something that you can put into a pill and have as a probiotic like you can with a like Lactobacillus or a Bifidobacterium. You have to find a way of getting it through your diet and then essentially propagating them through a good diet. So in that sense, yeah, missing microbes, but rather than a huge amount of diversity like we've talked about in the past, it may only be a few species.
Okay.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening. Hey, Food Junkies listeners, we are so excited to announce that Dr. Amy Reichel is joining our Sweet Sobriety team as our principal nutritionist. In order to celebrate this collaboration, we are offering our first nutrition course in April called Enhancing Cognition Through Nutrition, exploring the impact of food on cognition, emotions, and development. Amy has created an incredibly unique course that will teach you how our food choices actually influence our behaviors and how we think. We already know that food is an addictive substance. In this course, Amy is going to take a deep dive with you into how food actually changes our brain beyond the reward system. Dr. Amy Reichelt has a PhD in neuroscience, a Bachelor of Science with honors in psychology, and an advanced diploma in nutrition. She is a certified health and nutrition practitioner who has authored over 60 peer-reviewed scientific articles on food addiction, cognition, brain development, the gut microbiome, and behavior control. In this workshop, you will get three live psychoeducation sessions. The first one is called The Brain Food Connection, Cognition and Nutrition. The second one is Feeding the Mood, all about food and emotional well-being. And the third one is Nurturing Young Minds, Nutrition and Brain Development, where she will discuss interventions and strategies to reverse the negative effects of poor nutrition on our brain development. We will have one last 1 hour session where Amy will answer any and all of your questions regarding this course and material. These courses will be held Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, starting April 10th and going April 10th, 17th, 24th. May 1st will be the live Q&A for all participants. Cost is $50. Can't wait to see you there. Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
Now, one of the things you said that struck me as a little bit worrisome is that we have a set point of weight. We have a set point of bacteria, and you can't really change that by taking stuff out of a bottle.
What's really interesting is that, and I do talk about this in my books, our microbiome is pretty much set in terms of a base microbiome by the time we're 2 years old.
2 years old.
Yeah, because that's essentially when we're starting to develop in that. Now, your microbiome will change over time, but it will be very subtle in the way that it changes. And so those first 2 years of life are incredibly important in order to be able to get a really nice base microbiome. And I think in that stage, this is where the idea of breastfeeding comes into play, where the idea of making sure that we don't have too many interactions with an infant in the first 6 months, because that's when you're starting to develop that initial microbiome. And then you start to have more of these connections, more of these experiences with other microbes as you're growing older. And then after the age of two, that's when we start seeing outside microbes, whether it be from other individuals, whether it be from outside influences, daycares. This is where we start to see the microbiome essentially being tested, and over time it will shift and it will change. Now, granted, you can change your microbiome by moving to a completely different location. People who live in the Far East have different microbiomes than the people who live on the East Coast of the United States, but those are more environmental, situational based. When you start talking about the microbiome based on diets, yeah, you really do want to have that nice base by the time you're 2 years old, and then continue that all the way up until about seven, because that's really when the immune system starts to really balance out. And then by the time you're 12 years old, you pretty much have a really good immune response. And then you can start testing sort of different types of diets and stuff like that. How many of us actually can remember children, including ourselves, following really good, healthy diets until we're 12 years old?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it really begs the point of be careful about antibiotics before the age of two, and also be aware of what you're feeding your child. So yes, there's breast milk, but a lot of people eating junk food.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think in that sense, we have to think of the whole life as an ecosystem for our microbes, starting from the moment that we're born until essentially the day that we die.
How could standard American diet affect infant into adulthood?
Oh, the idea of having simple sugars, saturated fats, those are really great for those bacteria that essentially produce those inflammatory byproducts, right?
Yes.
And so as a result of that, a child may find themselves having higher levels of inflammation as they're growing, but they may also have a lack of a proper balance inside of the gut. But more importantly, they may end up not having some of those beautiful gatekeepers as they're growing older. And so they may be more prone to problems, infections. They may end up reacting more severely to different types of infections, that type of thing. These are all the issues that we haven't proven through clinical trials, but there's enough anecdotal evidence out there to suggest that, yes, indeed, making sure that microbiome isn't affected by a less than healthy microbiome diet is probably going to help them down the road.
Okay, so under the age of two, it's really important to eat a good microbiome diet, because a lot of people can't control their diet when they're age two. It already sounds, from what you've said already, that the idea of customizing your diet later on to fix some of the problems is not really going to be that helpful because of this set biome at the age of two. So what can probiotics or customized diets help somehow rebalance or reset?
So you're never going to get a reset, because essentially that's just not how the way our ecology works. Okay. A perfect example of that would be if you have the most brutal antibiotics and you take doses and doses of, that's like putting a forest fire into a wooded area. But what ends up happening is that, as you'll see, life comes back very quickly, and it's the same thing in your gut. So what will happen is you will have a wiping out of a population in terms of its numbers, but you won't wipe out the population itself, and it will come back. So what you want to be able to do is change, through nutrition, the ability of certain bacteria to live and other bacteria essentially to starve them or to kill them off, that type of thing. And that's essentially how you do the change. Now, if you change your eating habits so that you have a more pro-microbiome or pro-healthy microbiome diet, then you will start to see that change in the microbiome. But the problem is that the minute that you change back to a SAD diet or something like that, those other ones are going to come right back. So it's a lifestyle change, okay?
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned probiotics. I love probiotics, don't get me wrong. But what they do is they maintain and prevent. They don't treat. So if you look at a really cool study that was done where they took sailors and they sent them out to 30 days at sea. Now, sailors don't eat particularly well when they're at sea. And what essentially was happening was that the idea was that the sailors' diets would lead to microbiome changes, and then the probiotics would either maintain or change the microbiome towards more beneficial. The probiotics maintained the balance of microbes. So essentially what was happening was that no matter what the diet that was going on, by supplementing with bacteria that could still produce those lovely, nice, happy byproducts, and some of these bacteria also produce sort of antibacterial agents, bacteriocins that kill other bacteria, which is cool. Lactobacillus acidophilus. It's really funny. I like to call it the mob boss of the bacteria, because you put that into any type of microbial system, it just starts killing stuff it doesn't like. But you can take those probiotic pills, and I was taking them for probably 30 years. Anyways, so the maintenance is there. And that maintenance would be really great for someone else who maybe has to travel and may not be able to eat for a very long period of time. Oh, I don't know, say an astronaut. And so right now, there are studies that are actually looking at the idea of helping astronauts maintain their microbial diversity using probiotics when they're traveling to the moon and maybe even to Mars. So in that sense, changing the diet or using probiotics can have an effect, but it's not going to be a treatment effect. It's going to be a maintenance or prevention effect.
So just eating a tub of yogurt isn't going to help if you've had a massive antibiotics, if you've had a 7-day trial of antibiotics.
Yeah. So what the probiotics in the yogurt are going to do is it's going to provide you with some bacteria that's going to help. But studies have been done that shows that you probably need to eat about 100 tubs, those little tubs of yogurt, in order to be able to get the same amount of bacteria that you'll need to prevent any kind of changes in the microbiome, which is why you want to be using the probiotics. Essentially, on a daily basis, you're looking at about 10 billion that you need, which is not bad. That's 2 or 3 servings of something like a raw sauerkraut or a couple of pills. But when you're talking about something like an antibiotic treatment, you're probably needing somewhere between 50 and 100 billion. So that's when you really need the pills.
Okay. The idea of binge eating or restricting, which are both very common behaviors in the food addiction world, what do they do to our microbiome and the ecosystem, basically, in the gut?
Okay. Let's get into the idea of how binge eating or restricting ends up affecting the gut microbiome, okay? Now, we talked about a little bit about diversity and the gatekeepers, all right? If you start finding yourself in a situation where you're eating a lot of food that does not help to promote these gatekeepers, all right, then what ends up happening is that you potentially could lose them, which is going to help inflammation. But another thing that you're going to end up losing are other bacteria that actually depend on a good microbiome diet. And these are the ones that are producing some of the metabolites that are going to be beneficial for your body. Now, I'm going to introduce one of those metabolites to you. It's called a short-chain fatty acid, SCFA. You've probably heard about it. You've probably heard some of the names like acetate, butyrate, propionate, okay? They stink to high heaven. And when you have lots of short-chain fatty acids in your diet, or in your gut, and you go to the bathroom, you know that they're there. But the beautiful thing is that these short-chain fatty acids are known to have anti-inflammatory effects. And studies have actually shown that they can also help anti-obesity. They can help to protect the organ and metabolic processes, and they can also help to prevent constipation. Okay, so short-chain fatty acids, those metabolites, are incredibly important. If you start binge eating foods that are high in simple sugars, loaded with saturated fats, you're going to lose a lot of those short-chain fatty acids. If you restrict yourself from eating, then you're not giving your bacteria a heck of a lot to actually do anything with. So you're going to lose those short-chain fatty acids, all right? And when this happens and you start to lose those short-chain fatty acids and you start to have a greater inflammatory profile, then you start to see the tendency towards non-communicable diseases. Now, add that into some other aspects of mental health, societal influences, and that can lead to various eating disorders, such as anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, and that only contributes to even lower diversity, and it becomes essentially this great spiral and this horrible detrimental cycle that is occurring where it gets worse and worse and worse. And the worst part about it is that you can get to a point where you're almost unable to be able to get back to normal nourishment for whatever the reasons may be. And as a result, you're not going to be able to help that balance. And that's when you start to have a dietitian come in to be able to slowly start introducing how to get to a much better place when it comes to your microbiome. And I know a lot of people out there are going to say, you know what, Jason, I've seen people who have tendencies towards anorexia or who have bulimia, and yogurt can help them. No, it can't. It can do a little bit, but it's not going to do what you need. It has to be that lifestyle change, and it's not going to be immediate. It has to happen over time.
And it's because of these short-chain fatty acids that are...
The short-chain fatty acids essentially help to reduce the level of inflammation. And again, we know that a lot of these diseases or disorders have an inflammatory component to them.
And these are made in the colon. And you're saying that when you have just to go back to that concept of poop, that when you have a particularly odorous experience, that it's probably high in short-chain fatty acids, which is actually a good thing.
Yeah, there are a number of components that are in that particular substance that comes out of you. So there's a standard smell that comes from something called indole. There's that sort of vinegary smell. Yeah. That's the one that you are really looking for, because that's the acetates and the butyrates. And then there's a smell that has almost like it's like a petrochemical process. And butyrate is where you're coming in with that, or propionate. What you're hoping not to have, okay, is essentially a smell that you would associate with something like diarrhea or something like that, because those are not short-chain fatty acids. Those are other byproducts that are being formed as a result of overgrowth or growth of certain types of inflammatory bacteria. And again, it's one of those things where if you change your immediate diet just for a day or two, you can actually change the way that your gut smells over the next couple of days. You can actually test this, right? One day, if you just want, have really takeout food or something along those lines, whatever, and see what it smells like. And then a week later, have just perfectly healthy foods and try that. And then another day, try beets, and then get freaked out at the fact that you have red.
Okay. I was really interested that you're saying that our brain is programmed for food deprivation.
Our brains have not changed a lot since we became Homo sapien. And way, way back then, we were very much just like all the other animals. We had to forage or we had to hunt. And our bodies were essentially used to food deprivation. Okay. What has happened is that our brains are still programmed for food deprivation, which means that if we don't get food at a certain regularity, we start to get concerned. We start to get worried. It has an effect on us. Okay. What's also important for you to understand is that when you eat, there's a satiation that comes with it. And there's a reward that comes with it that your brain feels. What food addiction comes from is the fact that the food industry has made food readily available. And that has altered our brain's perception. Because now, instead of needing a reward every few days or something along those lines like it used to be, we need a reward every few hours. And now we're finding foods that are allowing us to have that reward so that we can essentially not feel deprived or concerned or worried. Now, in terms of gut health, the reward that we tend to have that's associated with food addiction comes from rapidly degradable sugars. And those, as we know, are not associated with bacteria that produce those short-chain fatty acids. So what ends up happening is you get the reward from the ultra-high processed food. It has no ability to help you control the immune system or the inflammation as a result of the fact that you're not getting those good bacteria creating those short-chain fatty acids. And then you create an inflammatory profile. And inflammation, as we've already talked about, has an effect on the brain. So it's going to amplify how that deprivation feeling occurs. And then again, it starts to create that cycle because you're going to need that ultra high processed food in order for you to feel good. And then you're not going to have the starchy fatty acids to help reduce the inflammation that's going to contribute, and circle, circle, circle. And before you know it, you're essentially eating constantly, even though you don't even want to eat, because it's all being programmed by your brain. And those bacteria that are leading to this higher inflammation are allowing it to happen even greater.
Okay. The keto community is very adamant about saying that saturated fat is healthy and that we've had a fear-mongering response around saturated fat. But you're telling me that saturated fat is problematic for the gut bacteria. Can you just touch on that a bit more? Because I know that people listening are going to be going, hey, what's this about?
Yeah. So when you're looking at the keto diet, right, it was originally designed to help epilepsy. But the whole idea is that instead of a short chain fatty acid, what they want to do is to be able to help promote these medium chain triglycerides, these MCTs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that you're going to get these MCTs is through the use of saturated fats, like a coconut fat and stuff like that. Where the problem lies, however, is the fact that saturated fats can also lead to the production of inflammatory metabolites, especially if it's animal fat. And when that happens, it's going to have an effect on your circulatory system, your cardiovascular system, possibly your organs and your metabolites. So the whole idea of a keto diet is to be able to make sure that those saturated fats that you're getting usually are plant-based, not meat-based. I think what's happening is that there's a focus on lipids from a different source. But at the end of the day, if you're looking at it from a gut microbiome perspective, you want to create those short chain fatty acids instead of medium chain triglycerides. So that will have a beneficial effect on your immune system.
You also mentioned something about this concept of sugar and then fat. There's evidence that there are separate neurological mechanisms of fat and sugar. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's an absolutely fascinating thing. When we start talking about the links from the brain to the gut, essentially through the vagus nerve, what we find is that there are branches from the vagus nerve that will lead to connections with different neurons, and they themselves have different receptors that will react to different types of molecules. Perhaps the best way of explaining that is if you've ever put a hot chili in your mouth, it's really hot. And the reason for that is that there's actually a receptor in your mouth called TRPV1 that sends a signal to your brain that it is hot. Also, you have this TRPV1 in your intestines. So sometimes you'll eat hot food and then you'll get the second hot food later on as it's being digested. And all of a sudden you're sweating and you're just like, why am I feeling so hot? But simply because it's in your gut, it's hit those TRPV1 receptors. It makes you feel hot. So that's essentially what we're talking about. Now, there are certain receptors for sugar, and then there are certain receptors for fat. This has been done. This has been tested. It's all really cool. So when you have sugar, it's going to send a reward up to your brain. And that's great. When you have fat, especially saturated fat, it's going to send a reward signal up to your brain, which is great. Here's the thing. When they are signaled together, like you're eating ultra-processed food, then they overlap, creating a massive amount of a reward, okay? And when that happens, then you start moving into this idea of addiction, because now you start to crave that reward, okay? This has two problems. The first one is that, yes, indeed, if you start getting into this addictive cycle, you're going to start eating more and more, and that can lead to food addiction. The second one, which I continue to run into, is the fact that if you only do one and not the other, so if you're just eating lots and lots of sugar like honey, it's going to put weight on your body like nothing else. But you're not going to feel the reward. You're not going to have the addiction. You're just going to be like, I like honey. Okay, this is really cool. And then you just eat and eat. And before you know it, you're eating 50 grams of sugar in a sit down, especially with peanut butter, just by the way. Oh my goodness. But anyway, then all of a sudden, you're no longer having the reward, the addiction, but you actually are still doing something that is antagonistic to your body's health. Same can happen with fat. And this is another thing that you might see when people are talking about keto, is that people feel more sated. They feel more calm and comfortable as a result of the fact that, yes, indeed, the fat is leading to signals up to the brain, and they're not having the sugar that's going along with it. So when that happens, you essentially are having an effect on your body that's going over time, and you are creating a cycle, but you're not creating an addiction from it. So you have to be careful if you're only going to focus on one sugar or two fat when you're ingesting, because it still may end up having consequences that are separate from your gut bacteria, but still end up essentially being more detrimental to you. And I've done this a couple of times in my life where I've done the honey bio, and sometimes you're just like, why wouldn't you gut bacteria give me some warning?
Okay. The honey story that you're talking about, we would probably identify as some form of maybe a low-grade addiction, but you're saying that you don't have cravings for more, but still you're eating 50 grams. Yeah.
So what ends up happening is you're just sated by it, right?
Huh.
And then you just essentially are having it and it feels really good. The difference why it's not an addiction is because, at least for me, I'll just say, all right, that's it. I'm not having any more honey. And then that's, I may not touch it again for 6 to 12 months.
Oh, I see.
I can just stop it, right? It's just something that is really nice and it tastes good. So in that sense, it's not necessarily addictive. It's just the fact that I'm not getting the sense that there's anything bad happening from it and you just gain weight. And in that sense, it's completely separate from the gut microbiome. But what it also does is it just gives you a sensation of realizing how complex the entire gastrointestinal system happens to be. And when you add in the fact that it connects to your brain and then you've got the whole axis that's going on there, it just becomes, you do the best that you can.
Okay. So listeners, we only got through half of the questions that I wanted to ask, only half. And Jason has already agreed that he would come back and do a second part. How can we actually apply this knowledge to treatment? So with the promise that we are going to continue on it with a focus on treatment. So Jason, I'm going to ask our signature question that we always ask at the end. If you could tell a younger version of yourself something about the role of the gut in addictive eating or eating in general, what would it be? Something you tell the younger version of yourself.
Don't eat so much honey. Because honestly,
on that,
the one thing that I never quite understood, and even today, it still boggles my mind, is how is it that I can just start eating this one thing, this really awesome thing, and it is healthy. Honey is very healthy, but in moderation, and not even realize that I'm doing it until one day you're looking in the mirror and you're like, where did that come from?
Okay.
So in that sense, as much as addictive eating is a problem, being sated and just focusing on one particular type of food to give you the nourishment that you're looking for is also something you probably don't want. Keep it diverse, keep it mixed up, because that way you can know that you'll never get into a trap, whether it be through addiction or just simply through convenience.
All right. Thank you very much, Jason, for this introduction. And we're going to have you back to talk about treatment.
Absolutely. Thank Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.